we saw significant growth within the ecosystem.
This country has pushed towards building up, being an incubator for startups.
You're watching it, you're placing bets, in-game bets, and that's it. And you're hoping that you're obviously going to win.
Have countries wisened up and decided that they wanted their own slice of the cake?
I mean, I was in New York and I'd go down the road and I'd see a billboard where it would be fast city, fast money.
And welcome to another edition of the Sigma podcast, where today I'll be joined by Russell Mifsud, and the director and gaming lead and global SME for KPMG. Good afternoon, Russell.
Good afternoon. It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you to you and to Sigma Group for having me.
And thank you for accepting our invitation.
Pleasure.
Russell, your background, how did you get into the gaming sector? Okay. I know you offer through KPMG, you offer consultancy services, but you've also done quite a bit in the sector. Just a bit of a background also for our viewers.
Well, my dad had started off, he was working at a land-based casino throughout my years of growing up, so I always had a kind of casino background. And after I had finished studying, I had studied economics and management. I had a short stint in recruitment, whereby I was dealing with the digital sphere. The gambling sphere obviously fell within that vertical. And then I became an affiliate, primarily faced UK-faced sports books. I was the director of the operation, which was a UK and Maltese company. And it allowed me to start to build up a deeper understanding of how sportsbook works, build up some deeper understanding into what the challenges are, the marketing side of things. And it, of course, we're going back to 2009, 2010. So the industry parameters were a lot broader then. I remember being really impressed and excited over my first LAC.
LAC, London Affiliate Conference.
Yeah, absolutely. It was an impressionable experience. I loved it, and I spent about 4 years doing that. I was in charge of kind of like black box measures of being able to generate revenues through our affiliate
stream.
When
you say black box measures, what do you mean exactly?
Well, we had a system that would be able to help generate money then for our users, but of course then I was in charge of the monetization. So I used to work very closely with the likes of Betfair, William Hill, Victor Chandler back then, before all the mergers and new names came into play. I had about 150 bookie relationships, but they were all UK-faced. We had done well, but then came a point where I was like, I'd like to leverage what I've learned over these past 4 years, but then also leverage what I had studied on the economic side of things. And an opportunity came about to basically send in my CV to KPMG. KPMG was looking to create kind of champions, they were calling it, within specific verticals. And had a chat with the senior partner at the time and the head of tax. And they basically offered me something which was completely out of the box. So I've been very fortunate, very lucky. The firm's allowed me to kind of build up my understanding of the industry from a kind of 360 degree viewpoint. The brand often allows you to get closer to people. And what I found was I had insights on the affiliate front, but that was only one slice of something that is far more convoluted. But then when you speak to one person, you understand a little bit more about the industry, you speak to another person, leverage that insight, and you come to a point where you start having discussions where you can start to join the dots yourself and make sense of it. And that was a very exciting time.
But you have a very interesting background on a product perspective. I mean, your background is in sports book, but I know you can hold your own on a casino discussion as well. How important do you find it in your job to know the product?
I think it's key. I mean, I'm not going to pretend to understand the ins and outs of an operation as well as a COO, for instance, will know it. But to understand the ecosystem that it works within, to understand the risks, the opportunities, what's happening in the industry, I think that that's the difference between being potentially technically very capable and competent, but then being able to have a meaningful discussion, build up a connection with somebody by being able to speak that same language and understand what the way in which that person, the world that person operates within. And that allows you to identify solutions that are bespoke to the industry.
You just used a word which I like a lot, ecosystem. Mm-hmm. And we call the Malta gaming sector and its own ecosystem from which other ecosystems have grown and developed. You were in this industry 2009, 2010. 13 years later, how have you seen the industry evolve? Let's start in Malta. How have you seen the industry evolve over here?
So we saw significant growth within the ecosystem, being able to passport that license, the tax benefits, the fact that even, I'd imagine, operationally, it was a fair amount easier back in the day. We certainly saw a lot more operators then coming into the space, unlike today, where we see far higher barriers to entry to be coming into the sphere, whereby you're either going to be looking at groups that have very deep pockets, or you may be looking at experienced exec teams looking to replicate what they've done well in the past, or sometimes regulation. We'd see, let's say, a dot country, so like Germany, when you see regulation coming into a particular territory, then it would prod a particular group that may be outside the gambling sphere, but has competitive strengths, let's say, on the media front, to test the waters to jump into the space as well. Go ahead.
If I may, you just used the words barriers to entry.
Yeah.
And this is something which I find a bit weird. This country has pushed towards building up, being an incubator for startups.
Mm.
But in reality, the way in the gaming sector, because there's quite a bit of emphasis on being an incubator for startups in the gaming sector.
Mm-hmm.
But if you look at the way regulation has evolved, if you look at the change from .com to .country, and to a certain extent the MGA needing to adapt to that reality, I actually think it's much harder for startups to come into the country. And you using the words barriers to entry seems to confirm that. Or am I making too much out of it?
No, I definitely tend to agree. It's far harder to be entering the space, not least because of the number of licenses you need to be securing and ramp up from a compliance perspective. Today, the industry is, I mean, if you get something wrong, it's not a slap on the wrist. No. It's significant fines. So you need to go in. It's not start up a business and then do an introduction to iGaming. You need to really know your stuff to be getting into the space. I think one thing that we lack in Malta, and I think something that's going to be addressed, is we wanted to create that kind of incubator. Now, true, we've got the workforce, we've got the English language, the geographical location, the time zone that we've got, but the investment is tough. We have a lot of wealthy families here on the island, but the approach to investment, capital investment, is not as mature as you find in many other parts of the world, where you may find certain...
You're talking about local Maltese families?
Exactly. Typically what we find, although the intentions are there, is it's not mature enough to the extent where, okay, we will put in this amount of money and we'll trust you to run this business and provide us with things. Everyone wants to have a hold on the business, even if there is minimal to no experience within that sector.
And knowledge. And that ultimately would actually backfire on the running of that particular company.
Yeah.
So if I may ask, so you've seen foreign companies or foreign setup trying to attract local money, local investment, in order to set up over here?
Seen cases of it, seen even drives then for people to consider setting up a business. Put it like this, if there was a more sophisticated arm of investment, it would be one extra reason for a business, be it B2C or B2B, to potentially then be establishing itself.
Yeah. What do you say, a more secure arm of investment?
If there was an arm, if they knew. So one of the things that I look at as well is the video game side of things.
Okay.
And I think one of the most interesting things that Malta's kind of got up its sleeve is we aren't just looking at the gambling. Gaming Malta and government is trying to grow now the video gaming arm. And I think that that's interesting because the online gambling sphere is not going to remain as it is now. What was like one of the most innovative things probably happened about 12 years ago where we look at in-play mobile betting, right? It's how this immersive gameplay is going to evolve. We start looking at things like AR, VR. I think Flutter just rebranded their PokerStars VR brand today. Looking at what the next generation is going to be demanding or expecting, which is going to build up elements of loyalty, the fact that we're talking with a lot of video gaming companies that are also interested in entering the gambling space in some shape or form.
But do players want that sort of product?
I think it's a super good question.
I'm going to...
Yes.
When I was more involved in the B2B sector, I worked in the B2B sector, there was a huge fuss about the cross-convergence between skill games and gambling.
True.
And I remember being in Vegas for G2E, and mention being made of these products and actually seeing the products, which actually died a natural death very, very close after G2E. Yeah. They just didn't work. Why? Because the players wanted the look and feel of the traditional casino games.
True. And I think it's a super valid point. But, so if you're a big fish, right, and you're a whale or something and you want to go in and you just want to quickly have your gambling fix and cut out any of the fluff that comes with it. That's true. But you mentioned Vegas as well. Mm-hmm. I know Vegas has got a concern with looking at the number of slot players, the demographic. Mm-hmm. The demographic is still primarily
it's an aging
on penny slots and things like
that. It's an aging demographic. But then what does Vegas do? Well, if we're going to talk about Vegas, we have to talk about the resort, the integrated resort model, which actually still attracts a lot of young people.
True.
The pools, the clubs.
True.
Top-notch restaurants.
True.
So it actually becomes an immersive experience from an entertainment point of view.
True.
And most hotels nowadays make most of their money through that, not through the casino.
True. But let me give an example then. So if we're not looking at millennials per se, but if we're looking at Gen Zs, Gen Alphas, the eventual Gen Betas.
You're going to need to explain those age groups, what they are
so
exactly.
You're looking at millennials essentially are up until I think the age of about 45. I think Gen Zs are now roughly about 25 years old. If you look at Gen Alphas, then that's the next generation, more or less. You've got like a 10-year, 15-year gap between each one. Look at how cool, let's say if we look at sportsbook. Okay, so you're going on to a sports book. We've seen little hints of it where you have, let's say, even from a casino perspective, VR casinos. That's tough because the technology isn't there yet. And until everyone has that headset, who's going to invest all of that money into building up that software? It would be a sunk cost. If you are looking at sports book, though, and we plug in other evolving technologies like virtual reality.
Okay.
Right now, we play a game. There's a game there's a game that's playing. You go down to the pub or wherever, you're watching it, you're placing bets, in-game bets, and that's it. And you're hoping that you're obviously going to win. Imagine if you could be wearing a headset and you could actually be sitting down in the stadium watching that game. Imagine how more immersive that would be. And
yes, but
is it to say, because let's look at technology and how it's evolving. It's not to say that that's going to be around tomorrow. But when you look at these big contenders coming into the space, so the US, if we're looking at Disney, true, it's going in with ESPN on the B2B side of things, but regulation brings in that comfort. And it's these big guys that will start to test the boundaries. And we're seeing that perfect storm brewing of the convergence of spheres. So 10 years' time, though I think it would be too far-fetched to be integrating a sophisticated VR system into the way in which people bet, I don't think so.
I beg to differ on a couple of points over there, which we actually tackled ESPN and Disney a few editions ago on this podcast. And we had a very interesting discussion about the investment at the time made by Penn in Barstool Sports, which, however, they then pulled out because, let's say, Barstool Sports are a particular brand, which actually performs very well on social media. Much, much better than ESPN does.
Yep.
So even I think the social media, the new channel realities that we have today, what used to work on mainstream media is not what works, does not translate automatically in today's modern media.
True.
Being YouTube, I'd say more YouTube, because there aren't that many other video service providers that we have. But we've spoken about Malta. We've spoken about the ecosystem. We've spoken about the growth. We've spoken about the limitations. Mm-hmm. Rest of the world, the dot country. Mm-hmm. How do you view how that has evolved? Have countries wisened up and decided that they wanted their own slice of the cake?
Well, I think if we put one factor into play, COVID definitely have fast-tracked a lot of jurisdictions' need or appetite to be regulating. Mm-hmm. COVID was a massive cost, right, for the world, and it's a way of doing it. You can also be saying that you're going to be protecting your vulnerable players. Mm-hmm. Every country, I mean, it's surprising that there's so little harmonization in the space, but every country has its own policy and approach. The struggle is when we see things like responsible gambling. Yes, it's a matter. It is a concern. And you go back to 2010 when everyone was making hay whilst the sun was shining. There was minimal to no responsible gambling. But today, I see it heavily politicized. And an example that I like to use is they see that linkage then between gambling and suicide. I don't see that direct link. I see gambling as a symptom of it, a symptom, but not the major cause. There are going to be many other factors, but gambling then is often the one that's in the front line in the shooting.
You've thrown this with just a few minutes to go, and that is a very interesting discussion to have. You've mentioned suicide, which unfortunately in our country has hit home for a bit too many people. Mm-hmm. You have, or rather we don't have, the proper support services, but that's another discussion to be had completely. But Russell, I'm going to take you up on that. We're going to have a discussion on this particular topic, and thank you for raising it. I appreciate it. But when we come to the rest of the world, the dot country approach, and also, let's also talk about the gray, so those operators who decide they don't take a license in any EU jurisdiction, mm-hmm. but they run their operation from another jurisdiction. Mm. How has that grown? Does that provide adequate safety nets for players? Is that the direction we want to go in order to actually grow on a commercial level?
Yeah. So I'll make a distinction between it being light gray, dark gray, and black, and the black being then a regulated market where there is a licensing regime mm-hmm. that is in line with Europe and an operator is choosing to target that market illegally. Let's class that as black. The lighter gray side of things, and we often see this as KPMG as well, we take a very careful approach to the clients that we can mm-hmm. take on. We do know that many operators do target light gray to darker gray markets, and it's about managing that risk. The legal sphere is super fluid, and we know most of our clients will have legal opinions that give them the comfort, coupled with their shareholders, legal counsels, etc., mm-hmm. as to why they believe they can enter that market. But we find a really varied approach. So today, I see if we look at it from a B2C perspective, you either find those businesses that have got a game plan where they want to be going in, either raising funds, potentially going into the US, potentially with an exit in 5 years' time, mm-hmm. 3 years, 5 years' time, that's going to have you, likely going to have you anyway, on the straight and narrow.
Okay.
Then you can find then other groups where you're saying, okay, so it's largely the grayer, the darker gray markets that are making up the margins for me and funding part mm-hmm. of the regulated markets. What is my game plan? Do I want to exit out to a reputable buyer, or do I want to carry on generating these revenues for as long as I can? Mm-hmm. So you've got kind of two different approaches. And I think when we look at the Malta side of things, just bringing it back, when we compare it to some of the other jurisdictions, the fact that Malta has been able to do what it's been doing for so long, a lot of the trends that we're seeing is these businesses that do have an ambition to be exiting to a reputable party down the line or have that US presence are typically then coming then through Malta's doors.
Okay. So for operators or even suppliers to target the US market, straight and narrow.
Yeah, I mean, we know that even when it comes down to the checks. I mean, we've seen the stuff without mentioning the companies, even from a B2B basis, the amount of scrutiny and the impact that that may have had then on shareholder value. But the checks, remember, I mean, the gambling sphere in the US, there's one core factor. They want to ensure that they rule out any form of criminal activity. So even if you go in and you're having to, I can't remember whether you had done this as well, Trevor, but they want to understand everything about your tattoos, your scars.
I told you that story. I was asked those particular questions during my intrusive interview, my interview process in New Jersey.
Yeah.
Because it's not just the company, but it's the key people who go through an interview process by the particular individuals, well, inspectors from the New Jersey regulator.
But, and perhaps this won't make me super popular, but then we do see a bit of, I mean, we know the approach to ensuring that everyone is squeaky clean in the US and have no skeletons in the cupboard. But then again, we look at RG, for instance. I mean, I was in New York and I'd go down the road and I'd see a billboard where it would be Fast City, Fast Money, and they're advertising one of the biggest brands. I mean, that's crazy. Or you're advertising betting brands then at local college stadiums, I mean, where you've got kids over there. So I think that there's, now I don't know whether the US is going to catch up, but I was told by somebody.
It's interesting, in the US you have the, and we need to, because we don't have much time, but in the US, so right now, college football, American football has started the season, and they have two big programs, College Game Day and Big Noon Debate, every Saturday on the day. The amount of sponsored content by gaming providers, it's almost as bad as the UK was up to a year ago with its in during the game advertising. Yeah. And maybe sometimes we tend to try and close the stable after the horse has already bolted. Maybe even in this case, other jurisdictions are not learning from other people's mistakes, right?
Yeah. Yeah, and I think that that's a good way to be closing off as well. It's when what we've seen in Europe, the ramp up of regulation and significant fines that have come into play, that the industry hasn't always been overly careful, where history looks to repeat itself in certain cases. FOB Tees is a really nice example, right? With that £100 and then nobody took on that. Nobody decided then to reduce then the stake limit, understandably to an extent, because then it's a game theory, right? If you're going to reduce it from one retail outlet and somebody else doesn't, then you're probably going to lose business. But the industry, and this is why I think associations are really key, because that industry association can be that divider, if you like, between those businesses that, once again, whose game plan is to be going down one particular route versus those that just want to make money, as much
as
money
as
possible, because that is having an impact then on the wider one, be it politically or be it to the suicidal side of things or anything. So everyone's working within the same ecosystem. It's just people have different game plans.
Yeah, but unfortunately, everyone then is put into the same bag.
Yes, and that is super challenging.
And maybe whether if the industry had organized itself in the same manner that the alcohol industry, maybe it would have been a different story.
Diageo is a really nice example. And perhaps one of those differentiators going forward will be the story that they choose to tell from an ESG angle.
That's another discussion to be had. Thank you, Russell. Pleasure. It was a pleasure having you here. And I thank you, the viewers. Also, I'd like to take the opportunity to encourage you to subscribe and also to like the videos which we are publishing on our YouTube page, SipMoWorld. Thank you so much.